I want you to imagine your child or grandchild walks into college. For 18 years of their life, you have successfully protected them. They're a little bit nervous. It's the first day of classes. They walk into that general biology class. They take a seat. They're surrounded by 150 of their fellow classmates. General biology 1. Take out a pencil, they take out paper, they're ready to take notes, and in walks their professor wearing one of those nice white starch lab coats. He turns around and he faces the students holding two books. He holds up the first one. He looks them all in the eye, he says, "This is your textbook. By the end of this semester, you'll memorize everything in this book. You'll be tested on it. You are expected to know everything in this book. You can buy it in the bookstore for $187. And he sets it down. And then he picks up that second book. And it's a copy of the Bible. And a lot of times they wait just long enough to see if there are any smiles of recognition from any of the students in the room. And they continue by saying something like, "Yes, and any of you in this room that think there are truths in this book, you are either going to fail this class or you need to leave right now." And with flourish, they throw it in the garbage can. Intellectual intimidation. Folks, it is real. It is prevalent. In fact, I was in the state of Montana about 2 weeks ago. Young man came up to me. He said, "Dr. Harab, they didn't just throw the Bible into the garbage can in my class." He said the professor actually took a lighter out, caught it on fire, and then threw it in the garbage can. Now think about that for just a moment. Our children are running off, and they're wanting to appear to be intellectually elite like their professors, because after all teenagers will tell you, when they hit about 15, 16 years of age, for some reason their parents aren't really intelligent anymore. So they basically discount anything mom and dad says. They hit college, and suddenly the guys in those white coats seem incredibly smart. And so they begin to put their allegiance in everything they say. For instance, Richard Dawkins, very well-known atheist, he said, "It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that." I'm here to tell you tonight, intellectual intimidation is real, and it is costing the souls of young and old alike. And yet, let me ask you as we begin, how much truth is there to this idea that all intelligent people have bought into this thing? I want to spend just a few minutes of tonight showing you the real truth. We're going to walk back in history, and we're going to peel back the curtain of the men that actually founded many of the fields of science. Because you see, most of them believed in a God and believed in the Bible. We're going to look at a history that your children, your grandchildren will probably never see. But it's a real history. For instance, if we were to ask the question, who is the greatest scientist that's ever walked the planet? Most men would probably name Sir Isaac Newton. This is the guy who basically, by himself, came up with many of the fields. This is a guy who mastered the fields of physics, calculus, mathematics, light, color, astronomy, gravity. This is the guy you probably would want to kick in the shin if you didn't like science in school, because he laid the foundation for it. And yet, Sir Isaac Newton wrote papers refuting atheism. The greatest scientist that's ever walked this earth, he writes papers not only refuting atheism, but defending creation in the Bible. He said, listen to this, "I find more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any profane history whatsoever." How about Johann Kepler? Johann Kepler was actually the founder of the field of astronomy. This is the guy, basically, who got it all started as far as the stars. He said that astronomy was thinking God's thoughts after him. God's thoughts. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. This man founded the field of astronomy that has now been hijacked and is teaching the godless theory of Big Bang cosmology. And yet, he went on to say, I see how God is also gloried by my endeavors in astronomy, for the heavens declare the glory of God. The man who literally founded the field of astronomy recognized the fact that, yes, there's a God. And he realized why those stars were there to begin with. You see, the bottom line is when you really start to uncover these fields, you recognize these were great men of science who also believed in a God. Blaise Pascal, man who came up with hydrostatics, differential calculus, he is the guy who actually came up with what we call Pascal's wager. Pascal's wager simply says this: how can anybody lose if they choose to be a Christian? Now, what do you mean by that? Basically, he's saying, okay, if you're an atheist and I'm a Christian, and we die and there is no God, nobody loses anything. But if you're an atheist, I'm a Christian, we die and there is a God, you have lost everything. So how can anybody lose if you're a Christian? Folks, it's a win-win situation. We could talk about somebody like Robert Boyle, who was the father of modern chemistry. In fact, some of you in here remember studying Boyle's Law. This is the guy you can thank right here. So you've got the founder of chemistry who not only believed in a God, this is a guy who put his faith into action. And by that I mean he did mission work. He actually used his own money to translate Bibles into foreign tongues. But here's the part I love the best. When Robert Boyle died, he had a large sum of money that he set aside to be put into an annual lecture. Now you would think the guy who founds the modern field of chemistry would want to have lectures every single year about chemistry. And yet, folks, the Boyle lectures every single year are proving the Christian religion. How about these guys? Nicholas Steno, John Woodward, fathers of geology. You know why they went into geology? Because they considered themselves flood geologists. They were studying what we talked about last night, the Noahic flood. We could talk about Carolus Linnaeus, the founder of the biological taxonomy system. This is the guy that I would like to kick in the shin, because when I was in biology, we had to name several of those Latin words. You know, you can't just be human. You've got to be Homo sapien. The one I loved the most was the rat. You know what the Linnaean taxonomy for rat is? It's Rattus rattus. Kind of fits. How about Samuel B. Morse of Morse code fame? You all know that he produced a telegraph. The very first message he sent across that telegraph was Numbers chapter 23, verse 23, "What hath God wrought?" In fact, it was Samuel B. Morse who said, "The nearer I approach the end of my pilgrimage, the clearer is the evidence of the divine origin of the Bible." And folks, understand what I'm doing here for you tonight. We're not talking about just a few little scientists here and there. You're talking about the father of the field of chemistry. You're talking about the founders of the field of geology. You're talking about Sir Isaac Newton. Richard Dawkins could not carry the shoes of these men, scientifically speaking. Yet he has the audacity to say, anyone who doesn't believe in evolution is ignorant, stupid, or insane. Folks, these people did brilliant science, and they knew that there was a God. How about Joseph Henry? Some of you may recognize this guy. He was actually the first director of the Smithsonian, which is, to me, is a tragedy in that if you've been to the Smithsonian Institute lately, you know it is now literally a shrine to evolution. They've got whole wings of it that are devoted to promoting this idea that man has evolved, and yet This is a guy who would pray before he conducted any kind of research. We move into the 19th century and we find men like Louis Agassiz, George Stokes, Gregory Mendel, all people who believed in a God and did great science. We look at people like Louis Pasteur. And you say, Louis Pasteur? I must be standing on a spot. I'll scoot over. Louis Pasteur actually said during his lifetime he was persecuted by the entire biological establishment for his opposition to spontaneous generation. To that idea that life just evolved from nothing. He was persecuted, and yet only his persistent and sound experiments finally compelled biologists to stop treating their patients' diseases with evolutionary-based ideas. We go to people like Henri Fabre or Lord Kelvin or James Clerk Maxwell. And you look at the last one, you say, James Clerk Maxwell, that one doesn't really ring a bell to me. Well, let me bring it home to you. This is a guy who Albert Einstein, called his achievement the most profound, the most fruitful that physics has experienced since the time of Newton. Now think about that for just a moment. If Albert Einstein is saying that you're pretty smart, folks, this guy was brilliant. So we ask the question, what did he do? Number one, mathematically, he refuted the evolutionary nebular hypothesis, which is still science that's being taught in colleges today. Number two, he scientifically refuted Darwin and other evolutionary philosophers. All right, let's move towards modern day examples. What about people like Sir Ambrose Fleming, who was a Christian apologist who wrote at least a book against evolution? In fact, he was the founder and first president of evolution protest movement. We look at other modern examples like George Washington Carver, Wilbur and Orville Wright, Wernher von Braun, one of the directors of NASA. All of these men believe in God and believe in the Bible. Let me give you one final example that I think really sums it up and stands out extremely clear. Many of you in this room may recognize the name Michael Faraday. Those of you who don't recognize the name Michael Faraday, you may remember Faraday's constant of physics. This is the guy it was named after. Brilliant physicist. Michael Faraday was actually giving a speech over in Europe on occasion, and I want you to read with me what actually transpired at that occasion. It was recorded. To my knowledge, there has never been another occasion like this one. He was giving a talk on an experiment that he had done recently. Michael Faraday was a master of knowing how magnets worked. He knew literally down to the atom exactly what they would do. Here's what happened. It says, a crowded gathering of distinguished scientists had been listening spellbound to the masterly expositions of Michael Faraday. For an hour, he had held his brilliant audience enthralled as he demonstrated the nature and the properties of the magnet. He had brought his lecture to a close with an experiment so novel, so bewildering, and so triumphant that for some time after he resumed his seat, the house was rocked with enthusiastic applause. Prince of Wales, afterwards who would become King Edward VII, he rose to propose a motion of congratulations. That resolution, being duly seconded, was then carried out with renewed thunderous applause. You could just imagine for a moment, the guy gets done, he sits down, everybody's excited, all of a sudden the king stands up, the future king. And all of a sudden the house rocks with enthusiastic applause again. And then everything started to die down. They wanted to see what Faraday was going to say after being recognized by the future king. I mean, what would he do for an encore? Strange silence settled over the room. The assembly waited for his reply, and yet he didn't appear. The reason that he didn't appear, only his most intimate friends knew what had become of him. For you see, this man was also an elder in a little Sandemanian church, and the hour at which he concluded his lecture was the hour at which they had their weeknight prayer meeting. He ducked out the side door. Michael Faraday was not concerned with the praises of men, but rather he was concerned with obeying God. I wish that I could say that about modern day scientists. But unfortunately, what I think we have done is we have bred a group of people who basically now, instead of being concerned with the praises of God, they are craving the praises of men. Now, what happens when that occurs? What happens when the year 2010 hits, you send your child off to school, and all of a sudden they're growing up in an environment where people don't, basically they don't even want to believe in a God, because if there's a God, that means that they are not as high or as superior. You're talking about people who've literally elevated themselves to the status of deity. Folks, I worked for 6 years of my life in the neurosurgery department at the University of Tennessee Medical School. You don't get people who think they're more godlike than neurosurgeons, trust me. These were people who referred to cardiovascular surgeons as glorified plumbers. For them to recognize that there's a God means that they're going to actually have to bend a knee in submission. So what have they done? They have now built up an entity that revolves around a theory that is godless. And that's what they're training our kids. This is a page out of a fairly new textbook. In that particular textbook, it says it's possible to trace human ancestry from the first cell through a series of increasingly complex organisms before arriving at our direct prehistoric ancestors and the evolution of modern-day humans. Do they give any at all evidence for it? Absolutely not. Basically, they're just making bold statements. They're making statements like, we're an animal, we share common heritage with earthworms. They're boldly saying that we came from some Big Bang explosion. Why? Because with that cosmic accident, you have nullified God. In fact, look at the last sentence on this page. It says, in a closed universe, a Big Bang may occur once every 80 to 100 billion years. Now, there may be some of you sitting out there tonight. Maybe you've got children or grandchildren who are in school, and you're sitting there thinking, you know, really, that's kind of neutral to the idea of God. Folks, you need to understand, that is anti-God. Because you just took the creation account away from the Creator. Our kids are learning that this earth is 4.6 billion years old. And folks, it is literally in just about every single textbook you can imagine. I put on the screen a bunch of science textbooks. Please understand, it's not just limited to science. It is now in history books, social studies books. I was talking to somebody here, either in this building or over at, I know I'm going to get this wrong, Fort Hill, Fort Mill, Gold Fort, something Fort. You know what I'm talking about. Who was a mathematics teacher. And he talked very specifically about the fact that, yes, in those word problems, they've got evolution. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. I'm one of those guys, I hated word problems. The ones I hated the most were those two stupid trains. You remember those trains leaving the station? Those trains have been replaced with Lucy and Neanderthal Man. And they want to know at what point would their lineages have crossed. Had a young lady in Jacksonville, Alabama come up to me. She said, Dr. Harab, there's evolution in my home economics book. I thought she was kidding. I said, are you serious? She said, yeah. I said, can you bring it to me? She did. First page, first chapter of a home ec book. Starts out talking about the evolution of man. Folks, on a book on how to clean house and bake biscuits. Last week, I was in Longview, Texas. A young girl came up to me. She said, Dr. Harab, who was Lilith? Kind of looked at her like, okay, they finally stumped me. I said, I'm not sure I understand. She said, Lilith, she's in my reading book. I said, give me a little more information. She went on to describe to me how in her reading book, Lilith was described as being Adam's first wife. and that the Bible can't be trusted because the Bible left Lilla out. Blew my mind. I said, can you bring it? Sure enough, folks, she brought me the book the next night. I've already got a copy. I haven't scanned it yet. This is a reading book that is talking about why the Bible can't be trusted. Because it leaves out major characters like Lilla. Parents, grandparents, do not think that they're allowing your children to get old enough to defend themselves. They start literally in the very first grade. You open up a first grade science book, and in that book it says, the earth has changed much since its formation 4.5 billion years ago. How many six-year-old children do you know of that are realistically going to question their science books? Now think about that for just a moment. So already that six-year-old child is coming to grips with their very existence through an evolutionary perspective. They march off to school the next year, second grade science book. Since its formation 4.5 billion years ago, the earth has changed. Reinforcing this idea. In fact, look at the last sentence on that page. In addition to these physical changes, life too has evolved on earth. So already at age 7, that young child is coming to grips with their very existence through an evolutionary perspective. What I want to do with you tonight is I want to show you. I told you on Sunday we're going to take an offense on this. I want to show you some of the problems with what our kids are getting. And I hope if you're a parent or a grandparent, you'll jot a few of these down. Because these are the evolutionary icons that your kids know about. In fact, do a little survey. When I get done here, ask some of the young people, have you seen some of these? Folks, for the most part, they've probably seen all of them. Because these are in just about every single textbook. For instance, the peppered moths are a classic evolutionary icon. On the screen, there are two moths. You can only see one of them. The story that they tell our kids is this. Prior to the industrial age, there were 95% of the light color moths you see, 5% of the dark. They said basically the birds could easily spot the black ones. They'd eat them off the trees. That's why the population was so slanted. Well, then the industrial age happened. Soot covered all the trees. The trees turned black. And lo and behold, the population shifted. So now you've got 95% dark, 5% light. They call this evolution in action. And in fact, they fill museums with exhibits of it. So our kids get it in textbooks. They get it when they go on field trips. And yet, lo and behold, the whole thing is garbage. For you see, the reality of it is, in 40 years of research, they've only found two moths resting on tree trunks. And you say, wait a second, Brad, back up for just a moment. You just showed us moths resting on trees. Yes, those are dead. They've either been pinned or glued. Number two, those moths do not have a tendency to choose a matching background. They don't care where they land, whether it's green grass, whether... Number three, and most importantly, the guy who made this initial discovery, his name is Kettlewell. Nobody has been able to replicate his findings. You know what we call that in science? Garbage. But here's what I want you to see. Friends, we've now known for well over two decades that these are faked pictures, that they're staged. That these are just used basically to get across this idea of evolution. So we asked the textbook writer, why do you keep putting them in the textbooks? Listen to what he said. Bob Ritter, he says you have to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? The advantage of this example of natural selection is that it's extremely visual. We want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they, talking about high school students, can look at the work critically. In other words, later on, they can determine whether or not it's true or not. We're going to use this because it sells the image we want it to sell. How about this one? I suspect If the adults in this room think back long and hard enough, you may remember an image similar to this in your textbooks. A fellow by the name of Ernst Haeckel drew these. The way we read this, if you start down here at the lower left, you've got a fish, a salamander, a turtle, a chicken, a pig, a couple of mammals, and finally a human. At three different stages. What I want you to notice, though, is across the top, these all look very much the same, very similar. Ernst Haeckel had bought into the idea that man goes through every one of these evolutionary stages in the womb. That basically, early on, we're all the same, and then we go through this fish stage, this salamander stage, this turtle stage, until finally we've evolved into human. So basically, the entire evolutionary process is covered in the womb. In fact, Ernst Haeckel said his turning point in his thinking was when he read Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. Just a quick note, those of you who really know your history, you know Ernst Haeckel actually visited Charles Darwin in his home, the Mount, when he was sick. And the only problem is, folks, this man right here, he lied. Completely forged his pictures. Now, you ask the question, do they still put them in textbooks today? Oh yeah, we've colorized them today. They're a whole lot prettier today. But folks, here's the point. Across the top, you see Ernst Haeckel's images that he forged and got kicked out of the University of Jena for. Across the bottom are the real McCoys. Now, I could understand if this man lied about it 10 years ago, maybe even 20 or 30 years ago, I could understand why they would still be in textbooks. But we're talking about a forgery that was over 100 years ago. Stephen Jay Gould, who was an evolutionist, died several years back. He wrote an article in Natural History magazine where he addressed these embryos, called the article atrocious. I want you to listen to what he had to say regarding the fact that we're still using these in textbooks. He said, "We should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered the 19th century textbooks, but we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by the century of mindless recycling that has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not majority, of modern textbooks." You see, folks, when you really look at the reality of it, that's just another evolutionary icon that we dismissed a long time ago. Yes, the young people, have you ever seen an image like this one in your textbooks? More than likely, all of them have. This series of transitions between a little bitty horse-like creature all the way up to modern horse. It's in textbooks. It's a classic. Here you see it starting here. Here's another textbook. Starts right here. Works its way up. This one's actually published 2004. The idea is they found bones of this guy down here. They call him Eohippus or Hyracothrium. And they assume that this was the ancestor of all living horses. Now let's think about that for just a moment. Using their logic, that means that through time, everything gets bigger, right? Why do we still have little mice? Why do we still have little insects? Because if over 60 million years, everything gets up to the size of a horse, can you imagine how ugly a chihuahua would be? Here's the truth of the matter. Herbert Nielsen said, "The family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in the textbooks. In the reality provided by the results of research, it is put together from three parts, of which only the last can be described as including horses." What I want you to really notice about this man's quote is when he said it. Folks, we've known since 1954 that this idea of these horses evolving, that's garbage. In fact, George Gaylord Simpson, he put it this way. He said, "The uniform, continuous transformation of Hyracothrium into Equus, so dear to the hearts of generation of textbook writers, never happened in nature." And yet we're still putting it in textbooks today. How about this one? Another evolutionary icon, vestigial organs. Now, you look at that first word and you think, what in the world is that? Vestigial organs, basically the easiest way to think of it is, this is what evolutionists say are your leftovers, things you don't need. If I were to give you a list of them, it might be things like maybe your appendix or your little toe or your tonsils. They say that that is a byproduct from animals in the past. In fact, if you look on this textbook page close enough, they say vestigial structures are remnants of an organism's evolutionary past. All the way back in 1931, there was 180 of them, allegedly. In other words, you had 180 things in your body that you didn't need. That list is pretty much gone today. But I want to show you very quickly just a little bit of history that I think is kind of fun to watch. If we go back to 1989, I see at least three of you out there who graduated before 1989. 1989, we're still teaching that the appendix is a vestigial organ. 1994, we come a little closer to us. We realize we got a human appendix being compared to the appendix of a horse. And they're trying to make the case that ours is basically shrunk up because we don't need it. It's just a vestigial structure. That's 1994. 1998, Grolier's Encyclopedia starts coming out with the truth. They said, long regarded as a vestigial organ with no function in the human body, the appendix is now thought to be one of the sites where immune responses are initiated. They know today that its removal increases a person's susceptibility to leukemia, to Hodgkin's disease, cancer of the colon, cancer of the ovaries. Oh, you mean it's got a function? Absolutely. In fact, just within the last 6 months, you know what they've discovered? Any of you in this room that have ever had just a major bout of stomach flu or maybe food poisoning, and basically you're throwing up everything all the way to your toenails, have you ever asked yourself, how does my stomach replace the good bacteria that I need? I'll give you a hint where it's stored. It's in your appendix. You know, when I was young, if you got strep throat three or four times in a row, you know what they automatically did? Took out your tonsils. They're not as quick to do that anymore because they realize the tonsils are one of the sites where immune responses happen very quickly. I'll tell you a funny story about vestigial structures. I was in New Zealand. It's been, I guess, about 2.5 years ago. Was doing a televised debate, three hours of televised debate. It was a surgeon, a fellow by the name of Dr. Joe. I'll tell you guys the whole story. It's kind of funny. Right before the debate started, I thought, you know, I'm going to be nice to this guy because I'm a Christian. I may be the only Christian influence he ever sees. So I walked over to him. I introduced myself. I said, tell me a little bit about yourself. Now, you got to remember, people over in New Zealand, they do speak English, but it's British English. And it's not exactly the southern twang that I'm used to. So I heard the man say, my name is Dr. Joe. I'm an atheist. I'm a surgeon. I practice homeopathy. And I'm a terrorist. I thought, okay, this is going to be a quick debate because I'm looking for exes. I thought, surely this guy didn't really just say he's a terrorist. So I repeated it back to him. I said, all right, let me get this straight. You're a surgeon. You practice homeopathy. You're an atheist and a terrorist. Well, when I said that, all of the camera crew, they just immediately erupted in laughter. One of them walked over and he said, no. He did not say that he was a terrorist. He said Taoist, T-A-O-I-S-T. So obviously I messed up right off the bat. About midway through the debate, I started asking him questions that I knew he couldn't answer. Looked into the camera, I said, Dr. Joe, could you explain to the television audience where the original matter for the universe came from? He kind of looked down and he said, well, we don't know that. I said, that's okay, don't worry about it. How about this? Could you explain to the television audience then how we got from non-living material to living material? He kind of sunk his shoulders a little bit. He said, well, we don't know that either. I said, don't worry about that. I said, how about this one? Could you please explain then to the television audience how we had the first self-assembled cell? how that bilipid membrane came together and we had those organelles. And I kid you not, he was literally staring at the floor by now. He said, well, we don't know that either. I asked him about two more questions just like that that I knew he couldn't answer. And then I switched gears on him and I said, hey, Dr. Joe, have you ever seen the brachial plexus in the arm? It's a nerve plexus. It sits right under your armpit. It's pretty big. If you've ever seen one, I mean, it looks like a huge spider web. It's one of the biggest nerve plexuses in your body. He perks back up. He says, oh, yes, yes, I've seen it. I smiled at him. I said, so you've actually seen this nerve plexus? He said, yes, yes, I've seen it. He said, I've even done surgery on it. I smiled at him. I said, so you're telling me you've seen the design in this nerve plexus? He said, yes, I've seen the design. And as soon as it left his lips, he realized what he just admitted to. He immediately crawfished on me. He said, but your body has vestigial organs. That proves evolution. And he began to reel off some of the things we're talking about. Oh, you've got an appendage. You've got... I smiled at him. I said, I tell you what, Dr. Joe, you've had medical training. I've had medical training. How about we take these cameras into a sterile operating suite and I'll just cut all yours out? He didn't want to do that. Because, folks, we know today they have a function. Listen to what R.L. Wysong said. Not too long ago, man was imputed to have 180 vestiges. Organs like the appendix, the tonsils, the thymus, the pineal gland, the thyroid gland, they were all on the list. He said, today, all former vestigial organs are known to have some function during the life of the individual. If the organ has any function at any time, it cannot be called rudimentary or vestigial. As man's knowledge has increased, the list of vestigial organs decreased. He said, so what really was vestigial? Was it not man's rudimentary knowledge of the intricacies of the body? Folks, just because we don't know what something does doesn't mean that it's evolutionary baggage. I was in a seminar situation very similar to this several years back. A young man came up to me on a Saturday. We were taking a break. First words out of his mouth were, just give me one piece of evidence. He said, I can't stay for the second hour. I've got to work the graveyard shift. He said, can you give me something that I can take back to my biology class? Now, anybody in here that's heard me speak so far, you know the odds of me giving somebody an explanation in 5 minutes just ain't working. I can't get my name out in 5 minutes. So I thought for just a moment. I asked him, I said, have you learned the geologic column in your biology class? He smiled. He said, absolutely. He said, in fact, he had learned what the different layers were. He said, we were tested over all the different ages. And you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. The Triassic, the Jurassic, the Carboniferous, all of the different periods. I asked him one question. I said, what would happen if we had a tree that started right here in the Carboniferous period and that had been fossilized and was actually standing all the way up through the Cretaceous period? He looked at me and said, shouldn't happen. I said, you're right. And yet we've got these fossils on every single continent. We talked for just a moment about the fact the only place you're going to find this geologic column is actually in the textbooks. It's another evolutionary icon. And we spoke for just a few fragments of a minute on the fact that these textbooks are using circular reasoning. And you say, Brad, what is circular reasoning? Imagine this for just a moment. Let's say we're out in your backyard. We're digging to put in a garden. And we come across a dinosaur bone. We look at that dinosaur bone. We go to Winthrop. We ask the geology department there. We say, hey, check this out. They say, oh, wow, where'd you get that? You take them right back to the spot where you dug it out from. They have already labeled that dinosaur bone as being 65 million years old. So guess how old they label the layer you dug it out of? 65 million years. If you find anything else in that layer, guess what it then gets labeled as? 65 million years. We're labeling the bones according to what layer they're found in, then we turn right around and we'd label the layer according to the bones. Folks, it's circular reasoning. I shared with him an ongoing experiment that I knew about going on just outside of Mount St. Helens. I'm actually going to be traveling up there hopefully pretty soon to do a video documentary of how quickly it's coming back. Folks, Mount St. Helens is one of the best evidences of creation, period. Because when it blew, they told us, they said, it's going to take hundreds of thousands of years for this thing to recover. Well, guess what? It's back. Steve Austin has been doing a lot of research there. In fact, if you look at the bottom of the slide, you'll notice there are two men in scuba gear. That's he and one of his colleagues. He was sharing with me one of the things that they found in Spirit Lake, just outside of Mount St. Helens. He said, when the volcano washed all the trees down into that lake, it stripped them of the branches. He said they were stacked on top of each other like cordwood. They would finally get water saturated. The heavy root end would sink down. It would bob up and down until it finally slowly settled to the bottom, standing straight up. He said, you swim around the bottom of Spirit Lake, and it looks like a forest. He said, on top of that, all of the sediment is filtering out slowly according to weight. He said, we're finding a layered effect down there. Now that's what he's finding in Spirit Lake that was caused by a catastrophe. And that's what we see in the fossil record, folks. If you look on the screen, just to make sure you understand what you're looking at, there are three people right here standing at a rock bluff. Those are five fossilized trees. What I want you to notice is they're going through several different layers. You got trees that are starting out in the Carboniferous period, working all the way up through the Cretaceous period. And it's not just one place. We got them literally all over the world. This one says in Germany, France, the British Isles, Nova Scotia, California, several eastern states, fossils that extend through several layers of sedimentary rock have been found. These are called polystrate fossils. And yet, don't expect your children to see these in their textbooks. Because think about it for just a moment. What is the one thing evolutionists need a lot of? Folks, they've got to have lots and lots of time. And this geologic column automatically builds in millions, if not billions, of years for them. Folks, if you've got fossils that are going through this thing, you've only got one of two choices. Either that tree sat there for millions of years while sediment slowly collected around it, or it grew up straight through limestone. Take your pick. Or the third option is maybe it was caused by something like a global flood, and this earth isn't as old as we think. You see, when they're teaching our kids the teacher's edition, notice what this says. Stress that the earth is thought to be at least 4.5 billion years old. Another evolutionary icon is that Big Bang. The idea that 18 to 20 billion years ago, everything exploded out into the universe. What do we need to know about that Big Bang? Could God have used a Big Bang to get us to where we are today? Have you ever stopped to think about the fact those textbooks never explain where the original matter for that bang came from? You ever thought about the fact those textbooks never tell you who pulled the trigger on the bang? They start literally with this picture right here. And here's what they tell our kids. They tell our kids that in 3.4 seconds, everything radiated out from a small ball in space into an organized universe. Now, folks, my 7-year-old is smart enough to realize there's a problem with that. We were driving around the car one day back home. He spoke up. He said, Dad, that's kind of dumb, isn't it? I said, what's that, Reese? He said, to think you can get an ordered universe from an explosion. I thought, yeah, my kid's getting it. I said, you're absolutely right, Reese. I said, just imagine if we took a stick of dynamite and we put that in your bedroom and we blew it up. He smiled. He said, probably wouldn't look any different, would it, Dad? Folks, do you realize the Big Bang violates two very fundamental laws of science? Number one, you have introduced matter into the world. Number two, you've gone from chaotic explosion to an ordered universe. Could God have used a Big Bang? If you have a Bible tonight, let me encourage you to open it up to Genesis chapter 1. Look at the first two verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Have you ever thought about what it looked like that very first day? Thought about what the earth looked like that first day? Let me show you. I can't show you an actual picture, but I can hopefully give you a little bit better picture. It was a water-covered heavenly body. Because what was the Spirit of God moving over? It was moving over waters. Remember, God hadn't brought forth land yet. So here we've got this water-covered heavenly body. Ask yourself this simple question. Do we know the boiling temperature of water? Absolutely. Scientific fact. Depending on what scale you go by, 100 degrees, 212, we know the boiling temp of water. Now, think with me for just a moment, folks. Big Bang explosion took place at a temperature that you and I can't fathom. Millions of degrees. How do you go from a million degree explosion to having a water-covered heavenly body? Fact is, you can't. You add to that, the sun, the moon, the stars, what day did they come into the picture? Day four. So, is there a way that faithful Christians can squeeze the Big Bang into this thing? Listen to me very carefully, not without a whole lot of compromise. And somebody says, well, Brad, maybe each one of those days wasn't really a day. It's the last thing that I want us to look at tonight. If you have a Bible, open it up to Genesis chapter 1. Let's see if we can determine just how long these are. You'll notice Genesis chapter 1, verse 5, verse 8, verse 13, verse 19, Moses is recording over and over the same phrase. He says, so evening and morning were the first day. So evening and morning were the second day. He's not only calling it an evening and a morning, he is putting a numerical adjective with it. He is putting a punctuation at the end of God's creative activities each and every one of these days. Evening and morning, day one. Evening, morning, day two. Now look at verse 14. God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and seasons, for days and for years. Folks, he gives you three time elements in that one verse. Days, years, and seasons. If each one of these was not a 24-hour day as you and I recognize it, but rather millions and millions of years, what, pray tell, is he talking about in verse 14? You know, if you really want the answer to this thing, all you got to do is use just a little bit of common sense. Ask yourself this question, when were the flowering plants created? Oh, don't make me sing the song. Day three, correct? Genesis chapter 1, we learn God created all the green flowering plants. Now, we ask the obvious question. If God put all the plants here on day three, we know that they've got to have sunlight, they've got to have water. The water was already here. Sunlight's coming the next day. So let's say, let's assume for just a moment, each one of these days was a million years. What else have you got to have? Got to have sunlight, you got to have water, you also have to have the right nutrients in the soil. Oh yeah, you also have to be pollinated. You know those little flying insects that drive you crazy that are coming out right now? They serve a purpose. They pollinate the plants. Now, folks, when did those little flying insects come into the picture? Day five. Are you really ready to take the position that God put all the flowering plants here on day three, and then we had to wait 2 million years before they could be pollinated? Folks, that's illogical. Look in your Bible at Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, where it says, for in 6 days the Lord created the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is. Okay, what does that leave out? Nothing in 6 days. Then you flip over to Exodus 31. Exodus 31, starting in about verse 15. where he says, work should be done for 6 days. The seventh, the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel should keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Can you imagine two Israelites standing up having this conversation? Well, you know, I guess we're supposed to work six long eons of time and rest one eon of time. Or do you think they knew, I'm to work 6 days, be off on the seventh, just like God did? Do you realize there's only one scriptural day where we're ever told that God took time and he stretched it out longer than what you and I would call as a 24-hour day? The long day of Joshua. And if you look in Joshua chapter 10, verse 14, you read, there has never been a day like it before or after it. In fact, two more verses, but I want to go to the New Testament. Mark chapter 10, verse 6, we find Jesus Christ speaking here. Mark 10, verse 6, he says, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. All right, now get that for just a moment. Jesus is telling us people have been here from the beginning of creation, and yet what are your children and grandchildren learning? They're learning this Big Bang happened billions of years ago. The earth is 4.6 billion years old, and that man's only been here for roughly 3 million. And yet Jesus said, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. You see, folks, as I see it, you got one of two choices. You can believe a man-made theory that's got all kinds of problems, or you can believe the words of the Son of God. The last verse I'm going to give you tonight is Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Paul here writing to the Christians at Rome. He says, from since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Folks, I promise you, I'm not going to do it. I promise you I could preach for an hour on that one verse. And there's some of you going, yeah, I bet he could. Think about what all he's saying right there. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes have been seen. That means somebody had to be here to do the seeing. That means man was here. But notice how he ends that particular passage. He says, so that they are without excuse. Folks, do you realize in the city of Rock Hill, in the state of South Carolina, and in the nation we call the United States, there are multiple millions of people who right now, as I'm speaking, are banking on an excuse of ignorance on the day of judgment. They basically already said, you know what? If there's a God, I'm just going to say, didn't know. Paul just ripped that excuse out from under their feet. He is saying, you can know there's a God. Look around you. Tonight I'm asking you, do you know that God? He is the creator. You may have walked into this room having a lot of allegiance in science. You may have felt like that was the intellectual position. Well, I'm here to tell you tonight, you need to follow the great intellect, and that is Jehovah God. We can prove he exists. Design demands a designer. What are you going to do with him? You can't ignore him. In fact, the Bible tells us that on one day, every knee is going to bow. If you are here tonight and you haven't obeyed the gospel, then I want you to think about this. The only thing that is keeping you from stepping out into eternity is you've got a heartbeat right now. And at some point, just like everybody before you, that heartbeat is going to stop. Where will you spend eternity? If you are here tonight and you need to obey the gospel, if you truly believe that Jesus Christ, that he died for your sins, and you're ready to change your life, repent, to confess his name, to be immersed for the remission of your sins, you can do that tonight. For those of you who are Christians, I hope and I pray that as we sing this invitation song, that you'll use that as a time of reflection, of examination. Because I suspect some of you may have walked into this room thinking, you know what? Science has got the answers. But folks, let me remind you, first off, it's not God versus science, because God is the author of science. Don't buy into the atheism, the evolution, the humanism. Put your allegiance right here. If you've strayed away, if you need to ask for prayers, I hope that you use this opportunity as together we stand and sing. All right. I'm not going to pick on Vet and tell that she's already asked a question. But she did. While I'm pulling up a couple of slides, easiest way to do it, if you've got a comment or question, if you'll just raise your hand while I'm doing this. There we go. I've seen the same article that you're talking about, and I could probably dig it out, but I don't know of anybody doing any active research in that area that's trying to use. Basically, it's almost a mathematic formula that says, statistically speaking, probability speaking, he's got to be there. But I'll be honest, I can't name anybody right off the top of my head that is working in that field. Other comments, questions? Yes, sir.
During the men's day, you were talking about after mankind was scattered over the rest of the earth, and the different skin tones prevailed in different parts of the world.
Yes.
How is that different from the theory of natural selection?
Okay. How's that different from natural selection? So I'm actually bringing that one up because she was asking me, how do we know the age of the earth? I talked to him on Saturday about the fact that we know there are people, for instance, that are darker skinned around the equator, lighter skinned up around Sweden. And we talked about how God dispersed people at the Tower of Babel. And that, so you got all these different colored people who are living in Swahili. Well, after a few short generations, it makes sense that you're going to have predominantly dark skinned people there, because the melanin that makes their skin dark actually is going to help protect from the sun's harmful UV rays. How is that different from natural selection? Basically, it's adaptation, which is not evolution. Evolution means everything came from a common ancestor. The one thing that I guess I need to clarify, just especially since you asked this question, do I believe in microevolution? Meaning limited, small changes within limited parameters? Absolutely. We know that happens. I can take two dogs and I can make a different kind of dog. I can take two different color people and get a different color. Like I can take a dark and a light and get a tan. Absolutely. We know microevolution happens. But that's very, very different from saying all species came from a common ancestor. Does that make sense?
Well, I was thinking about tonight you were talking about the
mall. Yes. Okay, yeah, right. Well, here's my thing. Natural selection was actually invented by a creationist by the name of Edward Blyth before Charles Darwin. And we got to remember, survival of the fittest does not explain arrival of the fittest. Two totally different concepts. Do I have a problem with saying that the weak die off? No. In fact, that may be God's way of kind of cleaning up the planet. But does that help me explain how we go from one species to the next? Absolutely not. Let me get to Ms. Yvette's question. I think it's in this one. Maybe not. Uh-oh, I might have to take another question because it's in my other. I'm looking. Oh, if y'all don't ask me a question, I get to ask you a question. Yes, sir.
Is there a code of ethics and scientific research to help refute these guys from setting this debunk theory out, or who had to wait for judgment day to settle all that?
Is there a code of ethics that helps? There should be. But unfortunately, and I don't mean this to be ugly, but right now the code of ethics in science is almost equal to the code of ethics in Washington, if that helps you a whole lot. Do what? Realistically, here's how it is in science. If I wanted to get a job, if I wanted to be a tenured professor at South Carolina University, I would have to publish papers, because part of me getting a tenure job is getting a grant. In order to get that grant, I've got to show that I can carry out research. The way we do that in science is we publish papers. If I try to publish a paper from a creationist perspective, it's going to automatically be rejected. And I can prove that one. We've got several guys who are actually documenting every time a creationist tries to submit good science, it gets rejected. So in order for me to get that thing published, I've got to do one of two things. I've either got to kind of play neutral, or I've got to carry the evolutionist mantra. So for me to get tenure, I've got to kind of tote the banner and keep my mouth shut, which is what most of them are doing. It's basically a situation of, hey, we're all in this boat together. I'm not going to tell on you. You don't tell on me. But the ironic thing is, when I was in school, if I talked to a professor one-on-one, like, for instance, we were doing brain recordings from deep within the brain. We took an electrode down. I'm staring through a dissecting scope. A neurosurgeon's across the table from me. We're looking at this brain, and it was one of those weird occasions where most of the staff was away from us. I looked up. I asked the guy, I said, do you think there's any possible way all this stuff just got here? He stopped what he's doing, looked over across the dissecting scope at me. He said, not possible. He said, there's no physical way. And he began to quote things to me that we were looking at. He said, how do you get voltage-gated channels? How do you get these ion-gated channels? How do you get a myelin sheath around axons? And he was just boom, boom, boom. One person literally came within our field of view, and he stopped talking about it. Because that's just basically they are going to quote the banner as long and as hard as they can. All right. A certain person wanted to know, how do we know how old the earth is? And I think I can now tell you. Yeah, here we go. I'm going to give you 6 verses to write down, and I'm going to go through these extremely quickly. And then I'll show you how we use those 6 verses to prove the age of the earth. I put them up on the screen, but understand I'm going to kind of fly through these. All right. Here we go. First one is Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And let me blow them up where you guys can see them. Second one is Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. For by him were all things created that are in heaven, that are in the earth. Matthew chapter 19, verse 4, he answered, he said to them, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? So in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. We know it was a creation event. Now we know there's males and females there from the beginning. In fact, Mark chapter 10, verse 6 is our next verse. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. The fifth verse is 1 Corinthians 15, verse 45. So it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last Adam was made a quickening spirit. So we've gone from knowing in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It was a creation event. Males and females there from the beginning. Now we know the first male's name. Who is the second Adam he's talking about there? That's Jesus Christ. My point is, you don't discount the first one, guys, unless you're willing to discount the second one. The next verse, Genesis chapter 3, verse 20, Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. Now, with those six verses in hand, what you can basically do is build a timeline. Open your Bible to Genesis chapter 5. And in Genesis chapter 5, you start reading, Adam lived 130 years. He begot a son. He called his name Seth. So Adam's 130. We drop 130 on our timeline, and we keep reading. We learn that Seth lived 105 years. He begot Enos. We add 105 to that. We're up to 235. Enos lived 90 years. He begot Canaan. We add 90 to it. We're up to 325. And all of a sudden, what you're doing ultimately is you're building a timeline that is showing you the age of the earth. And you look at that and you say, how can you say that's going to help me understand the age of the earth? Because in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It was a creation event. Males and females there from the beginning. First man's name was Adam. I'm just giving you his lineage. Do you think it's a mistake that we have the lineage from Adam to Christ in the Bible? And folks, when you do this, what you're going to find out is there's roughly 2,000 years between Adam and Abraham, round numbers. There's also roughly 2,000 years between Abraham and Christ, round numbers. How long is there between Christ and us? In round numbers, roughly 2,000 years. So it's pretty easy for me to see that if you go by the Bible, which is what I go by, Earth is less than 10,000 years old, a whole lot closer to six. Maybe one more question. Yes, sir. Great question. You going to be here tomorrow night? All right. He asked the question. He said, if the dinosaurs made it onto Noah's Ark, how did they become extinct? Before I ask your question, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask both these rows a question. Can I get you guys to raise your hand if you've ever heard of the Magic Treehouse or the Magic School Bus? All right. Thank you for doing that. Reason I say that is because tomorrow we're going to look at some pages out of both of those that, believe it or not, are wrong. To answer your question, I do think the dinosaurs were on the ark, and we're going to look at that tomorrow night. The reason that I think they died out, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, is I think after the flood there was a pretty big change. I think basically the earth changed a whole lot. The other thing that I think happened, what does man do to every animal that we're scared of? We kill them. We hunt them. Which animals are going extinct? It's the ones that we fear, the ones that we hunt. Guys, young and old alike love the dinosaurs. And if you want to know what is the hook that evolutionists are getting into our kids, they get them when they're about this big. And it's usually through the dinosaurs. Tomorrow night we're going to talk a lot about them. I'm going to show you some evidence that you will not see in a textbook, because what it is evidence of humans coexisting with the dinosaurs. Now that shouldn't surprise you if you believe the Bible, because the Bible says God created man and all land-dwelling creatures on day six. We just talked about the fact that these were literal 24-hour days. Appreciate very much your attention. I really do hope you'll bring somebody with you. You all have a very good night. See you tomorrow.